The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Welcome to Sunday Worship with the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Our fellowship is a principle-based, truth-seeking, justice-seeking, and welcoming faith community in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, on the web at tpuuf.org, and thanks to the wonders of technology and the wizardry and dedication of our tech managers here at TPUF, wherever you may be this lovely August morning. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee here at the Thomas Paine Fellowship. And let me remind everyone first here in the sanctuary to please turn off your or silence your cell phones to avoid unnecessary distractions and interruptions in this morning's service. And second, on behalf of the committee and the fellowship as a whole, I want you to know that whoever you are, wherever you may be on your life's journey, on your spiritual journey, whatever you must in conscience truly, responsibly believe, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you and invite you to worship with us this morning and every Sunday morning. I mentioned a few moments ago that our UU faith community is principle-based. As Unitarian Universalists, we're not bound to recite a specific creed to be welcomed into this community. We're not required to sign on to a prescribed set of beliefs deemed forever and unquestionably true. But our commitment to principles, I think, implies that we live by a fundamental article of faith. Namely, we believe that affirming and promoting those principles will help us become more loving, compassionate, and free, and to live a more ethical, moral, meaningful, and fulfilling life. And now, how do we come to more fully understand and apply those principles? Well, we derive answers directly from our unique personal experience of the world and of the diverse, fascinating creatures that inhabit it. And we derive answers indirectly by learning of and from the experiences of others, by reading what others have written and spoken. Which brings us to the theme of this morning's service, summarizing a summer read. This morning we'll learn what members and friends of our fellowship have found meaningful and worthwhile in books that have touched them and helped them to process their own life experiences and to live a principled life. And I'm all set for a summer read this morning. I got my folder with the seascape on it, got my fisherman sandals on, ready to go. That's why I suspect most, if not all of you, consider reading an essential spiritual practice that offers unique rewards and advantages. And more on this subject later in the service, because now it's time to light our chalice. The chalice and the flame together form the symbol of our free faith, signifying, among many things, our openness to the wisdom of many ages, traditions, and cultures, and our aspiration to keep the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the fire of commitment to freedom and justice burning within ourselves and throughout our world. This morning, let's let our chalice reflect the light that the written word shines on the world and that illuminates the soul. Its light brightens dark days and warm, cold, and dark and cold nights. It can bring to light what some would prefer remain unknown, hidden, forgotten, like the Holocaust. It inspires us to think and act more purposefully and more humanely. As American author Madeleine Engel wrote, a book can be a star a living fire to lighten the darkness, leading out into the expanding universe. Our chalice lighting words this morning are the lyrics of our gathering song, written by 19th century Universalist minister Samuel Longfellow. He was an accomplished writer, but his achievements as a writer were rather overshadowed by the fact that his brother was the widely popular and world-famous poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Be that as it may, no less than 9 songs in our gray hymnal feature words by Samuel Longfellow. Seems that his writing definitely strikes a chord with UUs. All right, I apologize. Among those songs is hymn number 345, "With Joy We Claim the Growing Light." The Community Unitarian Universalist Congregation of White Plains, New York, will lead us in singing "With Joy We Claim the Growing Light." So please stand in body and or spirit as you're willing and able, and join in singing and proclaiming and claiming the growing light. The words will appear on the screen behind me and on your computer screen at home. "With joy we claim the growing light." And as I light the peace lamp, please respond by saying, "And with all the people of the world." May peace be with us. Now, this morning's service, as you've already surmised, is one unlike any you're likely to experience in other than the Unitarian Universalist community. Last year, we at TPUF revived a practice of organizing a service in August in which several members and friends of our congregation share some of the pleasure and wisdom they've derived from books they read or over the summer or recently. Now, I thought this year of inviting a young person in our fellowship to share a reading experience with us for the moment for all ages. And I'm grateful and delighted that Ryan McNeil, an accomplished and avid reader, agreed to share his thoughts on The Tales of Beetle the Bard, written by the phenomenally popular and successful author J.K. Rowling. Ryan, microphone is yours.
Thank you. Okay. My name is Ryan McNeil, and today I will be telling you about a book that I've read very recently, The Tales of Beetle the Bard. It is one of my favorite books, and it is so...
I'm going to take the mask off just to speak, okay?
Okay.
Here you are. Thank you. Continue.
Okay. It is one of my favorite books, and it is really a mashup of 5 stories. It was originally mentioned in a book called Deathly Hallows, which was the 7th original novel. It was actually written after the original books, and as I said, it is a mashup of 5 stories. One of them, which I will be telling you about, is called The Tale of the 3 Brothers. It is basically a tale about about three brothers who overcame death by making a bridge over a river. They each chose a reward. One of them chose a wand more powerful than any other. It ended up being made out of elder. The other one chose a stone to call people back from death, the resurrection stone. And then the youngest and wisest brother chose an invisibility cloak that could hide himself from anything. That would never wear out. I like this. I like this story the most because hard to explain. Well, I liked it the most because of all of the beautiful details and the more and it's not really told at the end, but if you get all three of those items or hollows, you will become the master of death. But yeah. The other stories, they're all themed around different things, and they were not actually mentioned in any of the novels. And I think that you should really read this book because it is fun to read. And if you read its summary at the back, it reveals something that's pretty funny. Thank you for listening to my quick talk.
Thank you very much, Ryan. I said it's interesting. This is a example, right, of a book, kind of like suggesting a book, right? When R.K. Rowling mentions this book in the Deathly Hallows, the last book in the Five Powers, the book didn't exist. But afterwards, she wrote the book, The Tales of Beedle the Bard, and there are something like eight tales in the book altogether, right? Five. Okay, you talked about one of them. Thank you very much. Well, now we're going to hear from four adult members and or friends of our fellowship. But before we do, I'd like to put into some context why the theme of our service this morning is linked to our UU faith and rightfully qualifies as a spiritual practice. Some of you may know that the Quran, the pillar of Islam, refers to Christians and Jews as people of the book because of the role that one book, only one book, that is deemed definitive and sacred is required to play in their lives. Well, I think we UUs could aptly describe ourselves as people of the books, plural. Our written sources of knowledge and wisdom are far-ranging and far-reaching. Writings from all the world's religious traditions, including earth-centered traditions, and writings from the humanist tradition, from philosophy, history, literature, and science. And we're just as likely to feel enriched and inspired by a chapter from a great work of fiction or nonfiction, or a passage from a great poem, a Buddhist tale, a Native American prayer, or a treatise on the latest discoveries in quantum physics or on the origins of the universe. Just as enriched and inspired as we may be by a passage from the so-called good book. In some cases, I would say much more likely. And one of the most appealing features of Unitarian Universalism for me is that it doesn't demand that I rely on just one book to nurture my spiritual growth. It doesn't imprison my spirit between the covers of just one book. One book produced by one culture in one language in one chapter of human history. Now, UUs trust that revelation didn't begin and end somewhere between 2,500 and 2,000 years ago. For UUs, for us, revelation, the revealing of the mystery and wonder of the universe and of life on this earth, is an ongoing, never-ending process, continuing throughout history, in every culture, in every corner of the world, including our own, right here. And so UUs will keep on reading, I suspect. I've spoken with many, many UUs who attest to the importance of certain books in their lives, but I've never heard one UU say, ever, that all they ever needed or wanted to know, they found between the covers of just one book. Our faith derives from many sources. We're compelled by an innate, insatiable drive to continue to learn more about the world around us and about what it means to be fully, wholly human. Scientific research verifies the many benefits of reading, from lowering blood pressure and reducing stress, to increasing motivation, from mitigating depression and narcissism, to preventing dementia and cultivating empathy. But one benefit for me kind of trumps all the others, that reading connects us with ourselves and with others. Even others we would otherwise not even know about, let alone come to know as if they were cherished family or friends. Maya Angelou once wrote, "If I were a young person today, trying to gain a sense of myself and the world, I would do that again by reading, just as I did when I was young." And Virginia Woolf claimed that reading allows us to slip involuntarily, often helplessly, into another's skin, another's voice, another's soul. That's why I truly, responsibly believe that reading, particularly reading well, what is well worth reading, is a spiritual practice. So I'm eager to learn what readers Butch Larsenese, Francesca Zappacosta, Mike Berkheimer, and Susan Hare have to say about books that they found worth reading. So in that order, I'll turn the lectern over to them. Butch?
Thank you, Jerry. I generally read nonfiction books. Sometimes the history of JFK or anything, crop circles. This time I was reading a book and it was called Once Upon a Time on the Nature of Fairy Tales by Max Luthi. He was a German professor of literature in Germany, and he wrote on a lot of subjects, but he wrote this book on fairy tales to talk about general principles. This is a really interesting book. It's sort of the Hero with a Thousand Faces for fairy tales, but it's much easier to read on the first round. It took me like 4 complete times to read A Hero with a Thousand Faces to finally get it. I knew there was something there, but it took a while for me to get it. But this was easy, and it was chock full of information. I enjoyed it, but to tell you all that information would come out pedantic. So I'm going to take a cue from Ryan McNeil, where he said there was many stories, but I'll share one. and you'll get the point. It's just a lot better. I don't think this is a tale you may have heard of. I will read it, and I'll tell you what the author thought about it, and then I got a few of my insights. This was called The Tale of Mr. Oates. Once upon a time, many years ago, there was a king who had a daughter, and she had many suitors, but she rejected them all because none was pleasing to her. Thus, she contrived to make a man for herself. She took a kilogram of almonds, a kilogram of sugar, and a kilogram of oats, mixed them all together, kneaded it into the shape of a man, and placed it before the saint's image in her house. Then she knelt down and began to pray. 40 days and 40 nights she prayed. And after the 40 days, God brought to life this man of oats, and people called him Mr. Oates. He was extremely handsome, and the whole world heard about him and knew his name. So too did a queen in a very distant kingdom, and she decided to go and abduct Mr. Oates. She had a golden ship built with golden oars and traveled to the city where he lived. Then she said to the sailors, "Go ashore and seize the one who is distinguished by his handsomeness and bring him back to the ship to me." When the people heard of the arrival of a golden ship, they all ran to see it, as did Mr. Oates. The sailors recognized him, and they seized him and at once dragged him onto the ship. In the evening, the king's daughter waited and waited for Mr. Oates in vain. She inquired everywhere and learned that a queen had seized him and sailed off with him. What was to happen now? What could she do? She had 3 pairs of iron shoes made and started out on her search for Mr. Oates. She went to many lands. She left many lands. She traveled far away from the world and finally came to the Mother of the Moon. "I wish you good fortune, Mother of the Moon." "And good luck to you, my dear girl. How did you get to this place?" "My good fortune brought me here. Have you seen Mr. Oates anywhere?" "How could I, my dear? This is the first time I heard his name. Sit down until my child comes. It travels around the world and may have seen him." When the moon came, its mother went over to it and said, "My child, this girl here wants to know if you have seen Mr. Oates somewhere." "How could I? I haven't seen him. She really should go to the sun. It sees more of the world and may have seen him." The moon and its mother gave the king's daughter an almond and told her, "Whenever you are in need, break it." Later, she receives a walnut from the sun and the sun's mother, and a hazelnut from the stars and the star's mother. The princess took the hazelnut and left. She traveled many different roads and finally arrived at a place where Mr. Oates was kept. Disguised as a beggar, she went to the palace and saw him, but he didn't recognize her, and she said nothing. She went to the servants and asked, "Won't you let me sleep with the geese?" The servants took the princess to where the geese were kept, and in the morning, when she awoke, she broke the almonds. Out came a golden spindle with a golden reel and a golden wheel. The servants saw this miracle, and as fast as their legs could carry them, they ran to the queen and told her about it. The queen listened and then said to the servants, "Run to her and tell her to give the golden spindle with the golden reel and the golden wheel to us, and ask her what she wants in return." The servants ran back to the beggar girl and asked her. "I will give you the spindle," she said. "All you need to do is bring Mr. Oates here to me for one evening." "What harm could be done in letting him spend an evening with her?" said the queen. "What can happen?" In the evening, the queen gave Mr. Oates a sleeping potion, and Mr. Oates had scarcely finished drinking it before he fell asleep. The servants picked him up and carried him to the beggar girl, then seized the golden spindle with the golden wheel and left. Now the princess began to speak to Mr. Oates. "Why won't you wake up? Here am I, who prepared the almonds, who kneaded you and prayed. Here am I, who made you, who wore through three pairs of iron shoes in order to find you. Do you not have a little sympathy for me, my dearest?" All night long she extorted him, but how could he wake up? In the morning, the servants came and carried Mr. Oates away. The queen gave him another potion, and he woke up. The second night passes in the same fashion, and the foreign queen gets a golden hen and its golden chicks, which emerge from the walnut. The hazelnut finally contains a bush of golden carnations, and now the third time comes a turn of events. Nearby the goose house, there lived a tailor, and all night long he heard the conversation. He took Mr. Oates aside and said to him, "Your Majesty, may I ask you a question? Where do you sleep at night?" "In my house. Where else? And why do you ask?" "Mr. Oates, for the last two evenings, as I closed my eyes to go to sleep, I have heard the beggar girl in the goose house who talks all night saying, 'Mr. Oates, why don't you wake up? I have worn my shoes out in order to find you, and you don't speak to me.'" Mr. Oates understood. He went to his horse and got it ready. And in the evening, when the queen again tried to give him the sleeping potion, he did not drink, but pretended he had fallen asleep. The servants picked him up and carried him to the beggar girl and took the carnation bush away with them. When the princess began to pour out her grief, Mr. Oates arose, embraced her, and at once they mounted the horse and left. In the morning, the servants went to get Mr. Oates again. But where was he? When the queen learned that Mr. Oates had disappeared, she began to cry. But what could she do? She spoke, "I too will make myself a man." She ordered the servants to crack open some almonds and mix them with sugar and oats, and from this she kneaded a man. She knelt before him, but instead of praying, she uttered curses, and after 40 days, the man rotted and was thrown away. The princess returned to her kingdom with Mr. Oates, and they lived happily ever after. What shall we make of the story of the Oats and Sugar Man? Sugar is the crucial ingredient, and this gives us a clue. Viewed psychologically, our princess creates her own lover. She does not love another human being. She loves an image that she has made for herself, and which she now cares for and caresses. She does not love another, she loves herself. Psychologically speaking, she makes herself an ideal image, which she transfers to a person. She does not really love the other person. She loves the sweet image which originated within her. But the fairy tale tails her away from this person she has made. And the princess who only wanted sugar, oats, and almonds now has to run around until she has worn out three pairs of iron shoes. She has to experience suffering and privation. Not until her creation has been alienated from her can she regain it. The man of sugar has now become an individual, and she loves him now for his sake and no longer her own. I noted that the psychologist Carl Jung said that women project their dormant masculine qualities onto men until they can integrate those qualities into themselves. These dormant masculine qualities he named the animus. This is all a part of normal psychology. The four stages of animus development are: stage one, a woman's idea of a man is one of mere physical power, for instance, as an athletic champion or muscle man. An example of this would be Arnold Schwarzenegger. Stage two, a woman's idea of man is one of a suave man of action or romance. An example of this would be Bond, James Bond. In stage three, a woman's idea of a man is one of a professor or orator. An example of this would be Barack Obama. And then finally, stage four, a woman's idea of a man is one of a man as spiritual guide. An example of this would be Mahatma Gandhi. Men have a corresponding development with their dormant feminine qualities. Their dormant feminine qualities Jung named the anima. As Joseph Campbell said, myths and fairy tales are all about our psychology. Thank you.
Done. My name is Francesca, and for the first time I will not be talking about my daughter Sabrina or El Camino de Santiago. I want to thank Jerry to give me this opportunity, but I have a little comment to make here. This was extremely difficult for me. I am a scientist and I present all the time, but I present data. I have slides. I present what I produced. So that was already for me extremely difficult. Not having a slide, what? The other thing is I still read in Italian after 30 years in this country. I still read in Italian. And I realized that I read in Italian, my brain processes in Italian, my heart feels in Italian. And when I had to put it in another language, I was missing the words. So I ended up taking notes, writing the whole thing, which is not like me. I usually just talk, but this time I was just paralyzed. You know, how would I say this word, put it in Google? No, it's not exactly what I want to say. So let's see how this goes. When Jerry asked me to comment on a book, I was like, oh, wait, a book, okay, let me think. So the last book I had read was a peculiar book about Mormons pioneers. You know, I have the greatest respect for those people and what they did, you know, they're out west, but some of their organization, their choices were a little like, So, no, I wasn't going to talk about that. So I went home and I look at my books, and in 10 minutes, I pulled a pile of books like this and say, oh, I could talk about blindness, or I could talk about my brilliant friends. And those are all great books if you ever want to ask me about it, or The Incredible Life of Henrietta Lacks, or A Long Way to Water. And then I settled for this book. This book is extremely dear to me. So this is a book by Primo Levi and touched on the Holocaust. And the Italian title is Se Questo È Un Uomo, which in English would be translated If This Is A Man, which I think is an extremely powerful title that was then changed by the editor in English, like Survival in Auschwitz, which is kind of a generic title. Somebody gave me this book when I was 16 in high school, and I read it. And then I read it again when I was in my 20s. And then when I married my husband, I thought, you know, he had to read it. So we had to have an English version, and I read it again. And then I read it every 5 or 10 years for 40 years. And then I read it last week because I was concerned that sometime, you know, a book will mean something to you depending on which stage of life you are. And that happened to me, like there were books that I thought they were masterpieces when I was 20. And then I try again when I was a grown-up woman, and I was like, I cannot even deal with this. But I read this book again last week, and I still believe this is a phenomenal book. Now, you know, it's clear what this book is about. And there have been a lot of books, around this horrific period in time. And I have read a lot of books about World War II, but all the one I've read This book is the one that I judge superior on all the others. So just a little summary. So I will call this book If This Is a Man, because that other title for me is, should just go away. It's the account of the 11 months that Levi spent in Auschwitz. At the time, he was a 24-year-old Italian Jew. And actually, he was arrested not because Jew, but because he was in the resistance. He willfully surrendered the fact that he was Jew, thinking that maybe that was the lesser sin. And then so he had maybe spent a month in one of the Italian camps, which were, you know, life was still life. And then he was sent in one of the Auschwitz satellite camps from February 44. And then he remained there until January 45, when the Red Army arrived. Now, as at the beginning of January 45, with the advancement of the Red Army, the Nazis started evacuating all the concentration camps. But they were taking only those prisoners. I don't want to say they were healthy, because there was no such a thing, but they were able to walk. So through those, they are called the death march, and during which most of the prisoners actually lost their life. But Levi had just contracted scarlet fever, so it was extremely infectious. And so him with another few hundred prisoners were left behind with nothing. So he will survive, you know, in even worse condition, because by then there is nothing left, and he's debilitated by the year of labor and and by the disease for an additional 10 days until the arrival of the Russian army. So at the end, Levi was one of the 14 survivors out of the 650 Italian Jews that arrived with him a year before. You know, his story doesn't finish there, because Levi actually arrived at his home in Turin 10 months later. It took him 10 months to go home, and he immediately started writing this book. Actually, he says that he starts writing notes even while he was in the camp, to make sure that he could freeze in time what he was feeling at the moment. The book initially was not very well received by the editors, mainly because there was like, oh, you know, Europe just came out of this catastrophe. They don't really want to hear it. People don't want to hear it. So it took over 10 years for him to find a reputable editor that would publish his book. But since then, actually has been translated in 40 languages, as this considered one of the most significant books about World War II. That was introduction, right? So the book starts with a poem which kind of set the pace for the whole book. So the poem said, "You who live safe in your warm houses, you who find warm food and friendly faces when you return home, consider if this is a man who works in mud, who knows no peace, who fights for a crust of bread, who dies by a yes or no. Consider if this is a woman without hair, without name, without the strength to remember. Empty are her eyes, cold her womb, like a frog in the winter. Never forget that this has happened. Remember these words. Engrave them in your hearts, when at home or in the street, when lying down, when getting up, and repeat them to your children." So the poem, you know, is a clear invitation to the reader to be a judge of the horrors that were perpetrated by the Nazi. And I think explain the title, that therefore couldn't be survival in Auschwitz. I set the theme for the book because the ultimate question of the book is, can humanity survive in the midst of such inhumanity? That is where Levi really wants to go. So I think what makes it so powerful and so different from the other books about the Holocaust is that Levi has a voice that is very clear and very firm, but it is almost untouched by anger or by hatred or by self-pity. He's more like, the book is a testimonial. He wants you to be the judge. He doesn't want to feed you what you should be feeling. So, you know, again, I think this just put it at a different part with all the other books I have read. So he has an incredible concise style, maybe even because he was an analytical chemist. He has a fascinating narrative, and he described the events of what he called the Nazi Great Social Experiment, when humanity was systematically denied to people. When, in his word, men sank into the opaque torpor of beasts broken in by blows, when the blows no longer hurt. Or again, in his word, if it is a man, it is a man who killed, men who crave and suffer justice. It is no longer man who, having lost all restraint, shares his bed with a corpse, or waits for his neighbor to die in order to take his piece of bread. For him, this is the ultimate negation of humanity. So according to Levi, in the concentration camp, only three kinds of men could survive. First, those that were physically strong. Second, the ruthless. And third, those who had a skill that could be useful to the Nazi. Levi fell in the latter category because by being a chemist, he spent his second winter indoor. So he was spared of the hard labor and of the freezing temperature. However, most importantly, Levi feels that he survived because of Lorenzo. So Lorenzo, in Levi's word, was an Italian civilian worker who brought me a piece of bread and a reminder of his ration every day for 6 months. He gave me a vest of his full of patches. For all this, he neither asked nor accepted any rewards, because he was good and simple and did not think that one did good for a reward. I believe that it was really due to Lorenzo that I am alive today, and not so much for his material aid as for his having constantly reminded me by his presence, by his natural and plain manner of being good, that there is still exists a just world outside our own, something and someone still pure and whole, not corrupt, not savage, extraneous to hatred and terror, something difficult to define, a remote possibility of good, but for which it was worth surviving. But Lorenzo was a man. His humanity was pure and uncontaminated. He was outside this world of denial. Thanks to Lorenzo, I managed not to forget that I myself was a man. In honor of Lorenzo, actually, Levi named both his children after him. Levi died in 1986 for what was ruled a suicide, which came to a shock to a lot of people, comprised even myself, just for that lack of hatred that you can see in his books. Somebody say that, you know, Primo Levi died in Auschwitz 40 years later. You know, he never really recovered fully, despite all his efforts. I think this is, you know, again, this book has been with me for 40 years since, I was 16, and is by far the book I love the most. I understand that some people, you know, reading book about World War II is never easy, is always painful, you know, you never have a happy moment, so some people just don't like it, but I believe if you want to read one book about the Holocaust, it's probably that's the one. And if you do so, I would like to hear what you think. And if you enjoy, Levi was a pretty prolific, prolific writer. So among many other books he wrote, there is a second book which covers his journey home, his 10 months journey home, which I think is as enlightening as the original book. Thank you.
Hello. Even though I started a book club and we read mostly literature, my reading habits are almost overwhelmingly history books. So I teach history and so forth. One thing that inspired me recently, to go back to a book by a friend of mine, Joseph Bilby, was when Ned Hector, or Noah Lewis, was here, and he said that it took all kinds of people to win the revolution, the American Revolution. And I thought about that, and I said, huh, that reminds me of the Irish, the Catholic Irish in America in the American Civil War. You remember, slavery was not ended through the normal democratic means in this country or the Constitution. It was ended at the point of a bayonet. Had there been no war, I don't know when slavery in this country would have ended. And that required a victory in a war, and that required people in the North at the time to volunteer. One of the groups that volunteered, and it was different back then the way they did the army, was if you were a politician and you could get people to join up, they'd make you a general. And you would lead your troops to battle. And that had some bad consequences, though some of these political generals were pretty good. But Abraham Lincoln at the time had to get all the people united in the North to win this war. One group that was eager to prove that they were loyal and true Americans were the recent Irish Catholic immigrants to America, most of who came during the potato famine in Ireland in 1848. Don't know, you know, it's kind of forgotten now, but the greatest riots in Philadelphia history, most violent riots, happened in 1840s against the Irish Catholics. Churches were burned and so forth. They were seen as not loyal to America, they were loyal to the Pope. Well, and we read, those of you who read Gods of Gotham are familiar with that. Well, one way to show you're loyal to the country was Thomas Meagher, an Irish Catholic person who had fought for the Papal States and so forth, decided to raise an Irish brigade that would go and fight for their new country. They would show their loyalty to America, even though America, most Americans hated them, they would show their loyalty to America by fighting for their new country. And he raised a brigade from New York and Philadelphia. And the line he used was, remember Fontenoy. Fontenoy was a battle in 1746 where the Irish Catholics had joined up with the French to defeat the English. There was no country Ireland at the time. They didn't have a country. So he was going to show, hey, we are loyal to America. Remember when our Irish ancestors had fought for France, we'll fight for America. My friend, Joseph Bilby, who's the chief historian of New Jersey, of all things to be the chief historian of, wrote a book about it, The Irish Brigade. They would go into battle with the spring of green in their hats. And of all the brigades, a brigade was, on paper was roughly about 4,000 or 5,000 men. Of all the brigades, except perhaps the Iron Brigade, which was made up of Midwesterners, they suffered the highest rates of casualties of any unit in the Union Army. Approximately 4,000 men were casualties through the war. The brigade was so decimated by casualties, it didn't make it to the end of the war. They had to consolidate it. If you go to Gettysburg, there's a Celtic cross, the stony hill near the wheat field where they fought. There's a statue of Father William Corby, who was their chaplain, who right before they went in the battle offered them general absolution. So in case they died, they would go to heaven without sin. Their battle cry was clear the way. I'll just mention one battle which they particularly suffered heavily. Battle of Fredericksburg was a disaster for the Union Army. On December 13th, 1862, the Union Army made a bunch of mistakes and was, which I won't get into, but was forced to take the heights or hills outside of the town of Fredericksburg, Virginia. It was a suicide mission, basically. The Confederate artillery chief put guns with interlocking fire and famously said, "A chicken can't live on that field when we open up on it." One of the first groups to, because you could only fit so many troops in that area, one of the first brigades to charge was the Irish Brigade. They were so decimated with the cannon fire, the interlocking fire, the canister, which were basically soup cans full of sawdust and metal balls that would fire out of the cannon, would break, and would spread all throughout the area, were so decimated that Thomas Meagher could only write home, "Our poor brigade," to his Irish, to try and recruit, "our poor recruit more people, our poor brigade has almost disappeared." I think of this, and this book is, if you're interested, is an easy book. You don't have to be a Civil War buff or historian to read. It's well illustrated. But I think it's important to remember people like this, because things like the progress this country has made weren't free. And it took people who were not well liked at that time to, at least they were trying to show their loyalty, but managed to affect the country and help end slavery. Why Ned Hector did that, Noah Lewis, why he inspired me was, I think maybe we forget things like this, groups like this. It's maybe not fashionable to remember them, I don't know. But that's the book. And It's not a summer read, but it is something to think about.
Our final speaker this morning is joining us via Zoom. So we're going to switch over here so Susan Hare can join us.
Oh, I see. I guess I am on. Good morning. Okay. Good morning. I hope that you can all see me. I can't see that screen very well, so I'm assuming I'm on.
Yeah, you're not on.
Okay. I'll assume I'm on. Please let me know if I'm not. I guess I am. Good morning, everyone. I have picked a novel to share with you that I was very impressed with. It is a new book. It's called The Music of Bees by Eileen Garvin. I would like to try to show you the cover, if I can do this, by the magic of, I'm not sure that's going to show very well, but the cover kind of stands out, which is interesting. Eileen Garvin is a beekeeper. She lives in Hood River, Oregon, and this is her first novel. She, within the story, you learn a lot about bees, you learn a lot about beekeeping, and you learn a lot about pesticides. There are a lot of themes in this book that reflect our modern challenges today. She puts a lot into this story, but it is also a novel about characters. At the beginning of each chapter, she compares a behavior of bees to a human behavior that's in the chapter. The main reason I chose it to share with you is that the main theme of the story is a sense of community, how it's formed, and the impact it has on the main characters. Bees live in community. They depend on each other. And this reflects on you. You realize that they're doing the same thing. These are disenfranchised characters. They are quirky. Each one of them has a section of the book. They've overcome much. I'll just say that. I don't want to give too much away. But they become endearing to the reader and to each other through the story. There's a lot of humor. It's kind of a quiet humor in the story. And that makes it enjoyable. So at the same time that you're enjoying the book, you're getting a lot out of what she's saying about our modern world and the choices that we make in our modern world. Now, the reason I came to know it is because I'm in another book club. And the woman who picked the book said that because of it has a spirit of hopefulness about it. And since we're living in such an uncertain time, it's refreshing to read a book that has hopefulness to it. Now, I thought I would share with you a few of the comments that other authors have said about this book. I won't read who all these people are, but just so you can get a sense of what the book is like in case you might want to read it. It's just a new book. One author says, a hopeful, heartwarming, uplifting story. Someone else says, exactly the book I needed to read right now. I loved it. Someone else says, every page hums with hope. Another one says, genuinely touching. Another one says, an emotionally resonant story. A kind-hearted, hopeful, and beautifully detailed story. And I did read one, this is from People Magazine, this kind of puts it all in one sentence. An exquisite debut that combines a moving tale of friendship with a fascinating primer on bees. One person said that I read said she wanted to become a beekeeper after she read this story. So it does leave an impression. So when I read the story, the first thing I thought about is I would love to share this with more people because it's a neat book to know about. And it's got a hopefulness, but it's not schmaltzy. You know, it makes you feel good, but it's not sugar-coated. There's a lot in it that is very gripping and difficult to deal with. But just the fact that there's hope at the end and leaves a smile on your face, I think is something that we need today. And I really wanted to share it with more people. So when Jerry asked me, and I said, well, we're going to be away for the weekend with magic of Zoom, I can still share it. I thought of this book right away because it's just one that is uplifting and hopeful, but it's also very real. But I just thought of our community at Thomas Paine, and this book does have a sense of community to it. So I'm so glad I was able to share it with you this morning. If you want a good story, first of all, that's why I really wanted to share it with you. So it's a novel. So there's not as much, I won't say there isn't reality in it, there is reality in it. But the fact that this is her first novel really, I think, is an aspect about the author that is commendable. So I hope that you will maybe consider reading it. It's available at the library and it's available on Amazon and all those things, and Kindle and all of that. So thank you so much for letting me share this book with you. And I do, if you decide to read it, I'll be like Francesca. If you decide to read it, let me know what you thought of it because I think you will feel enriched and you will learn something about bees, which are so important to our environment. So thank you very much for letting me share it with all of you. Back to Jerry.
And thank you, Susan, and Mike, and Francesca, and Butch. And as I said earlier, that reading connects us not only with ourselves, but with others, and even others we would otherwise not even know about, let alone come to consider as family or friends. Right? We're going to move, it is Matters of the Heart, and I think we will do Matters of the Heart this morning. But we'll probably eliminate the closing song. I think that would, the title is all we really need to know here, right? Okay, about the closing song, which is Praise the Source of Faith and Learning. And we can do this on our own. Let's put some time aside here in our service for those who would like to share with us a joy lifting their spirit up or a sorrow weighing it down to bring that to the light of this faith community. If you're here in the sanctuary, you can come up here to the microphone on stage right and share. If you're on Zoom, Mike will instruct us how to do that. And we do have a musical interlude while we think about what you're going to say, right? Okay.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close with singing Spirit of Life. A video will pop up here on the screen momentarily once I get to it. Mm-hmm.
What a miracle it is, she writes, that out of these small, flat, rigid squares of paper unfolds world after world after world. Worlds that sing to you, comfort and quiet or excite you. Books help us understand who we are and how we are to behave. They show us what community and friendship mean. They show us how to live and how to die. And I should leave us too with one final insight about books and reading from that famous literary critic and philosopher, Groucho Marx. Outside of a dog, Groucho wrote, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. Anne? And I should extinguish our chalice, but not its light, which we carry with us into the world.